Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 20 million people right now in Nigeria, Ethiopia, Somalia, Somaliland, and Yemen are fighting off starvation, and in some cases, a cholera epidemic. It's the largest humanitarian crisis since World War II. But a recent poll says 85% of us here in the United States have no idea it's going on. Well, today, three reporters will take us there and clue us in, this hour On Point, waking up to the famine. You can join us on air or online. Where is the outrage, the empathy? Do you know this story intimately from your family, from a relief mission? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The Christian Science Monitor and csmonitor.com have recently published a five-part series and several companion stories on the looming famine. You'll find links to the series at our website, onpointradio.org. You'll also find a link to a coalition of aid groups that you may want to donate to. But now, to the three correspondents who covered this important story. First, in Nairobi, Kenya, is Ryan Lenora Brown. She covers Africa for the paper. Ryan, thanks for making time. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
Scott Peterson joins us from Istanbul, Turkey. He's Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Scott, welcome to you.
Thank you, Jane.
And Peter Ford joins us from Remigné, France, global affairs correspondent for the Monitor. Great to have you with us, Peter.
Hello, Jane.
Such an important issue. Ryan, I'll start with you. Tell us why you all embarked on this journey.
Well, the scope of what's happening right now in East Africa and parts of the Middle East is just unprecedented. The drought brought on by the recent El Nino in 2015-2016 is, by all accounts, the worst in at least two decades, perhaps five decades, perhaps more in this region of the world. So it's an extraordinarily significant event, not just for this part of the world, but for all of us.
And where did you go, Scott? Tell us where you all went.
Well, my reporting, I went to Somaliland, which is just one of the areas, obviously abutting Somalia, and then Yemen just across the Red Sea as well. Those are some of the areas that have been very, very heavily hit by this. And we really wanted to try and get a sense of the types of resilience strategies and how things have changed in those decades that Ryan was speaking about. Because basically, I mean, I, for example, covered in detail the 1992 famine in Somalia, which yielded George Bush's operation to send American troops. And we had the entire United Nations U.S. operation take place there. And it was a very steep learning curve. What we wanted to see was the difference between how those famines were dealt with and basically, you know, what lessons have been learned. And what we really found, certainly what I found in the areas that I went to in Somaliland, were lessons in resilience in long-term strategies by relief agencies, by the United Nations, to really efforts to understand what it took to make much cheaper and smarter interventions early on that would avoid a much more serious thing that would yield a famine that literally would have millions of deaths at the other end.
Peter Ford, we've certainly seen many horrible famines over the years. Scott mentioned Somalia in 1992. We've heard this is the largest humanitarian crisis since World War II. Give us a sense of what you saw where you were.
Well, I went to Madagascar, which is not currently on the front line. Last year was when Madagascar was facing the immediate threat of famine. Since then, they've had enough light rain to avert the worst disaster. And there were lots of international aid agencies on the spot in Madagascar, which is one of the poorest countries in the world. So they kept an eye on what was happening, and they could see the starvation creeping up, and so they could act on it. But what we've got now is a whole series of what Scott was talking about, these resilience projects. And what I was looking at with health projects, with water projects, with efforts to build people's financial resilience, with small livestock holdings. And I was seeing a relatively optimistic picture where I was a year after the worst of it.
Mm. An optimistic picture where you were. Scott Peterson, tell us where you were, what you saw, and really the arc of this crisis. Help us understand that.
Well, I think, you know, one thing to keep in mind is that a place like Somalia has for centuries experienced repeated droughts. And what has been different in recent decades is that those droughts have come much more frequently. So the old coping mechanisms that were inherent in a pastoralist and nomadic society, which Somalis are, you know, I mean, these are people who have, you know, have immortalized camels, for example, in their poetry, describing them as a living rock placed by God in the wilderness, whose life is as important as the tendons as one's back. So when they lose 80% or 90%, or in some cases all of their herd of camels, or that, you know, 80 or 90% of their sheep or goats, that means that they are absolutely decimated and that they've basically are no longer able to sustain themselves. So what I began to see, while also looking at, like, for example, stabilization centers and places where you have under five children, you know, exhibiting all the signs of normal severe malnutrition, you know, coping, being fed through straws, the kind of images that we've seen a lot. What I also witnessed and what was shocking to me was how willing Somalis were becoming to, you know, preparing themselves to do a different type of lifestyle. In other words, maybe mix up how much they were going to be farming, doing that kind of thing, or producing fodder for any livestock that may have survived. I mean, they were really thinking of exchanging some of these really very old traditions for something that was just going to be sustainable, recognizing that it no longer was.
Mm. Ryan Brown, you explain in the series, you all do, that these famines and near famines are dynamic processes. Talk about that a little bit and tell us a little bit of your experience where you were.
Well, I traveled to Ethiopia, which is a particularly interesting case study for this project, I think, in that it is the country perhaps most synonymous in the Western mind with African famine.
Right.
Now, I was not even alive during the famines of the 1980s, and yet one of the first things I remember knowing about Ethiopia is that this is a place that had terrible famine, that needed massive outside intervention from the West just in order to survive. And now, the story is almost a complete 180 in Ethiopia. The Ethiopian government manages more of its own drought relief than I think any other in the region, possibly with the exception of Kenya. And it has an extraordinary early warning system. It has an extraordinary drought management program and just has become a massive, massive regional success. So while Ethiopia was and has been experiencing the exact same weather as its neighbors, South Sudan, Somalia, it has not risen to the same level of crisis there as it has in its neighboring countries, in large part because of a very muscular, very smart government-led intervention. Mm. And it's not an uncomplicated one because, as we know, Ethiopia is not a democratic country. It has a quite repressive government. And so we can chat more at some point about, you know, the effects that might have on drought relief. But we really wanted to look, you know, for this series at what's going right. And Ethiopia has been a major success story in the region.
Mm. I want to talk more about that later in the hour. Scott Peterson, tell us a little bit about cholera. It's not just famine. It's cholera that's really devastating these communities.
Well, this is something that you know, all governments in the region try and keep a lid on in terms of how they describe it, because cholera is like a word of poison for them, and of course people would fear a cholera outbreak. But the figures are quite startling. I mean, in Somalia, for example, there have been literally figures up to just today, 70,000 cholera cases so far, with over 1,000 dead just across the water in Yemen, where we have a much less read on what's actually going, on what's actually happening. Figures released by the UN Humanitarian Organization today, literally saying they had 450,000 cases of cholera with no end in sight at the moment, and 1,900 deaths. So those are, and these are things that are created by bad water, and you know, compounded by malnutrition. It's a combination of all these things. And to be honest, most of the cases that I saw in Somaliland were actually, you know, certainly of children and those suffering from this acute watery diarrhea. This is the okay and accepted term for cholera. Mm-hmm. Children who were suffering from this, especially, and to their parents also to a lesser degree, were suffering from this because rains had actually come. And because they were so desperate, they either drank the water that had already been contaminated by feces on the ground or by, you know, the carcasses of dead animals, things like this. You know, the thing that was meant to solve their problem, which was more water, which would bring more food and more fodder for and keep their animals alive, was actually the thing in this case that was killing them or at least making them suffer much more. Mm.
Peter Ford, speak more about the children. What's the impact on the children?
Well, I mean, it's absolutely devastating. And, you know, for a child who is acutely, severely malnourished, runs three times the greater risk of dying if he or she is unlucky enough to catch cholera. So, I mean, they are so weakened and so unable to survive without outside help and without special nutritional supplements and all the rest of it, that to watch them in the arms of their mothers just listless and often without even the strength to cry, it's pretty harrowing. And I mean, I think obviously it's the children who are most vulnerable. I mean, adults can get by without eating for a long time. I was talking to a mother in Madagascar who'd been living on basically raw bitter cactus fruit and raw cassava leaves, some cooked cassava leaves, and she was saying last year she had been so weak that she could scarcely get up, but she'd really been frightened for her children, who were on the edge of death. They all survived, thank heavens, but they were lucky.
Ryan, we just have about 10 seconds left here before the break. Most Americans sadly don't know about this. They aren't aware of the hunger crisis that's going on in the Horn of Africa, in the Middle East, the places that you all have visited. How is this crisis so far off our radar?
Look, I mean, I think there's a lot of crisis in the world right now, and I don't fault Americans. I think people are paying attention to as much as they possibly can at a time, and we're just in a time of crisis as a planet.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the unfolding famine from Nigeria to Yemen this hour, how famines unfold and how we stop them. You can join the conversation. Do you remember Biafra in the 60s, Bangladesh in the 70s, Ethiopia in the 80s? Why didn't we learn their lessons? Did we? The Christian Science Monitor and the CSMonitor.com team have just recently published a 5-part series on the looming famine in Africa, the Middle East. We're speaking with reporters this hour, Ryan, Lenora Brown, Scott Peterson in Istanbul, Peter Ford. I want to play some sound here before we get back and hear the stories on the ground. Here's a CNN correspondent back in March, David McKenzie, covering the near famine conditions in Somalia. He speaks to this person, Fatma Hassan, who describes the toll that the famine has taken on her children.
I fled with my children more than 100 miles on foot, she says. Shankaran cried the whole way, she says. Little Rahma is exhausted. The UN says more than 6 million people desperately need food assistance. That's half the Somali population.
And then last month, PBS NewsHour traveled to Somaliland to report on the influx of nomadic community herders fleeing drought in East Africa. He spoke to this 30-year-old woman, the mother of 5 children, now living in a temporary camp.
She came here after all of her livestock, some 30 goats and 50 sheep, died from the drought.
I used to be part of a family of livestock herders, but now I've been forced to come to this camp where I don't have enough money to buy food and water. I am really suffering.
She gets some money from relatives, but says it's just enough to buy rice and perhaps an onion or tomato. She can't afford beans or meat.
And here is the Australian Broadcasting Corporation's news team reporting on the crisis just this last summer in Somaliland.
More than 1.4 million children across Somalia and Somaliland are at risk of acute malnutrition.
This is the worst malnutrition we have ever seen. Everybody here, everybody alive, has never seen a drought like this one. So malnutrition is as a consequence of the drought.
Millions of children, Scott Peterson, there in Somaliland, suffering acute malnutrition. Millions more across this region. Largest humanitarian crisis since World War II. I asked Ryan before the break, how is it that we don't hear more about this? How do you see it? Why not?
Well, I think that, you know, there has been a degree of compassion fatigue. And I mean, I think that Ryan's right in the sense that we have had huge crises that never mind domestic politics, which in the United States, which has obviously kept a lot of people occupied, certainly since November. But, you know, even abroad, we've had ISIS and we've had the counter-ISIS war going on in Syria and in Iraq. These have been two very, very large events. We obviously have North Korea building up. There's so many things. And so basically a famine like this, and also, you know, some of the footage, you know, the footage that in, you know, in the 80s helped define the Ethiopian famine, for example, that was so stark and so powerful, it's hard for that to float up to the surface where it really occupies everybody's brain space these days, because they are also seeing images of white helmets, you know, dragging children's bodies out of rubble in Aleppo, and, you know, and horrible stories as ISIS is kicked out of Mosul. I mean, there's just so much competing, and I think that people just have a limited bandwidth. But I think that if people do want to know, then you can find out a lot of information about these things, because, you know, we have published this five-part series in the Christian Science Monitor, but there is also a lot of work that is being done by the relief agencies, by the United Nations, also by fellow journalists, as you just pointed out. One thing I would just say about that is that in the examples that you gave, each of those had surviving children. And I have to say that I followed the case of one child who really looked like he was going to pass away, just a very, very, very young one. His family had basically given up. I checked up on him 3 days later, and fortunately he was alive. But his father said he'd come from an area where he knew families where all six of the children simply didn't make it. Now, were they part of the statistics? I don't know. Mm. I'm not sure that they were. But the impact, devastating, as Peter said.
Mm. Jane, if I could just jump in on one thing.
Please.
One problem is that this is a slow-burning story. I mean, you have a tsunami strikes the Indian Ocean or an earthquake damages Kathmandu and kills tens of thousands of people. Those sorts of catastrophes spark instant response because they're dramatic. But starvation, it creeps up in a less visible sort of way, and there aren't necessarily any sort of any events, any news pegs that an editor can hang a story on. I mean, I was talking to a communications officer at Oxfam, the relief agency, who is telling me that, you know, he's trying to whip up interest in these stories and to persuade journalists to go and cover them. And the sort of responses he sometimes gets are, well, you know, how much deader are the camels going to be this time than the last time we went? And it's a pretty cynical response, but it reflects news values, I'm afraid. And without TV coverage, there's very little chance of getting a public campaign going seriously. I mean, if there are not pictures, if there aren't news stories on screens, basically agencies don't try to run public funding campaigns. Mm.
Ryan and Lenore,
may I jump in quickly?
Uh-huh, please.
One thing also I want to say is you know, when we speak of these images of famine driving public interest and public money, you know, one of the double-edged swords here in East Africa at the moment is, and Southern Africa, is that there has been so much success in building resilience in communities, in famine prevention and drought management, that the images simply aren't as extreme as once they were. And so aid agencies pull their hair out about that, too, because they think we and the governments we work with are doing very well. And as a result, then people aren't as alarmed and don't donate as much money, even though, as someone from Save the Children said to me, you know, when the end of the crisis is actually in sight and the path to the end is visible because there's so much work being done, that's when we truly have the moral imperative to intervene, because our interventions can then be all the more effective.
Scott Peterson, talk about community resilience. You all mentioned earlier these resilience projects in these areas. This is sort of a new buzzword in humanitarian circles. Explain how important it is to survive one famine, obviously, but then just to be ready for the next.
Well, I saw a couple of excellent examples of this. One was kind of a long-term project that had been run. One of the organizations running it was Concern Worldwide, and they created these berkads, which are basically, you know, kind of traditional cisterns that collect water when there's rain, and you know, which can be used, you know, later on when there's a lot of drought. So they put together 15 of these west of the capital of Somaliland in Hargeisa. This is an area that's, you know, a little bit more green and that sort of thing. And of course, they had been doing this over the years so that they were already in place when actually the drought struck. Now that, of course, they also run out of water, they dry up, but at least it gave people a much longer chance to make a decision about when to move, if they needed to move, or what their situation might be. Another one, which was very interesting for me, and which received a lot of attention in Somaliland as well, was a WhatsApp group that was operated by a single sub clan. They only had 850 families. They had a group. This doesn't mean that every single farmer's got a smartphone who's saying, "Look, I'm suffering. Please help me." But there were certain members of their sub clan that organized a WhatsApp group with 300 people. It was called Caring in Somali, and they reached out to some of their clansmen in Britain, in the United States, and elsewhere, and they sent money directly using mobile phones, which is how Somalis often are paying for everything from fuel to food in the grocery store. And that was the most effective thing that you could possibly imagine. In fact, literally in the first month, they earned $20,000, and after 6 months, they had almost $250,000.
Oh,
and
goodness.
What was fascinating when I went out to speak to the beneficiaries is that even feeding 10 families would mean that 100 families would stay in place because they knew they could rely on food coming to that place, food and water.
Fascinating. Let's get Daniel in here from Toronto, Canada. Hi, Daniel. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello again. First of all, I enjoy your show.
Thank you. And
I would like to ask one of your guests a question regarding Ethiopia.
Okay.
She did mention that Ethiopia was a success story, relatively speaking. But my question is this. Ethiopia is not a democracy, it's a dictatorship.
Right.
Some call it actually an apartheid state. There is a small clique who come from a specific region in the country who run the country literally in a mafia style. We do know there is a connection between the absence of democracy and famine.
Mm-hmm.
Democracies don't starve. They don't let their citizens starve.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, Ethiopia is a government that jails, persecutes, and kills its own citizens. We have a large number of Ethiopians who flee the country, drown in the Mediterranean. Many of them live as refugees in Kenya, Sudan, even Somalia.
Right.
So
and
how could you just say Ethiopia is a success story? Because we do know there is a connection between the absence of democracy and famine.
It's an excellent question, Daniel. Thank you very much. Ryan, speak to this. You talked earlier about the repressive government in Ethiopia, and I'm glad Daniel brought us back around to it. How does that impact famine?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you're absolutely right to bring in that point, because it is what complicates Ethiopia's success story and makes it not an unconditional one. I mean, we even saw as journalists, myself and the Monitor's photographer, we had enormous trouble getting in to report on drought. And now we were going in trying to look at the ways, the strides Ethiopia has made since the 80s. And so we had actually a relatively positive spin on what we hoped to accomplish. And even still, we had remarkable difficulty getting in. Humanitarian aid organizations in Ethiopia also have work in incredibly restrictive conditions. conditions. You know, they tell journalists there is no such thing as cholera in Ethiopia. It is acute watery diarrhea, because that is what the government insists on calling it. Mm. Ethiopia does not have cholera outbreaks. It has outbreaks of acute watery diarrhea, which, by the way, it has one now. You don't speak of famines, you speak of food crises, and so on and so on. And so it absolutely does limit both what the government is able to do, but I think perhaps even more crucially, it limits the story that's able to get out into the world. And here we are talking about how important public awareness and public understanding is, you know, to supporting these crises, getting the money and the food where it needs to go. And that is a limiting factor.
And yet, however, Ryan, you write in your story, if Ethiopia was once the world's poster child for drought mismanagement, it is now the regional model for early warning and nimble response. I mean, it's funneled $700 million of its own money, you write, into drought relief efforts. It's got an innovative public welfare system, parcels out small amounts of money to cash, to people during parts of the year when they're really struggling. I mean, they are doing some things right.
That's correct. And, you know, I think, unfortunately, in sub-Saharan Africa, you might say there's very few countries that have both open promotion of democracy and human rights and very effective socioeconomic methods for delivering redress of poverty. And now why that is gets into a lot of much bigger picture questions, and whether Ethiopia's success is sustainable is also an open question. Mm-hmm. But I think we can certainly say it has been a major success for Ethiopia, how far it has come since the 80s in terms of famine prevention and intervention, early intervention in droughts.
Daniel, thank you very much for the call. Let's get Carlos in here in Tampa, Florida. Hi, Carlos. Welcome to On Point.
Oh, hello.
Hello.
Yes, I wanted to put some attention into Yemen, the situation there. There are 20 million people facing human disaster. Right now, the Saudi Arabia has a blockade of Yemen, with a naval embargo, which is assisted by United States, which provides logistical and intelligence joint military support to Saudi Arabia. The people in Yemen are in a specifically precarious situation because it's basically like a peninsula. They are surrounded by water. In every other case, people are able to escape to adjacent territory. In this case, the only adjacent territory is Saudi Arabia, which is the place are throwing the bombs at them. So they have the Red Sea and I don't know. So, they are surrounded by water, so it's difficult for them to escape.
And the bottom line is the U.S. is contributing, right, to this, Scott Peterson, because of the blockade that's in place, right?
This is absolutely correct. And in fact, I think one of the biggest frustrations that I had in looking at this famine series was our inability to attempt or to get into Yemen. I mean, in 28 years of reporting, this is probably the first time I've actually failed to get into anywhere that I really wanted to get into. And really, after 2 months of effort, jumping through every single hoop, being told that we needed to get visas to both the rebel side in the north and also the Hadi, the Saudi-backed government in the south, I finally got those visas, at which point the UN informed me that, due to the Saudi insistence, no journalist was able to fly on their UN flights or any relief agency flights, areas that were totally controlled by the rebels, like Sana'a. So they really clamped down. It's the reason why for months there has, in fact, this entire year so far, there have been almost no reporting on the ground from Yemen of this incredibly dire situation. And as Carlos in Florida said, the UN today said more than 20 million people are in need in Yemen, more than 20 people, and 10 million of those are in acute need. These are huge figures, and yet there's almost no way to quantify that visually or even textually, except for what the aid agencies in UN are able to tell us in their own reporting. But of course, those aren't independent journalists. But this has been deeply frustrating, and the Saudis have been instrumental in making sure that this is not covered. Mm.
Peter Ford, with that in mind, what do we now understand about famine that we didn't even as recently as the 1990s?
Well, I think what aid workers are beginning to understand is that there is a closer connection than they had previously drawn between
development aid and humanitarian emergency aid. I mean, the idea is that the sorts of resilience projects that they're running, they give farmers and herders something to hold on to when drought strikes, rather than having them cycling endlessly in and out of disaster. And what they're doing is using humanitarian aid, if you like, for development purposes, or vice versa, using development aid for humanitarian purposes, but doing projects, small-scale projects, providing clean water, for example, which reduces the risk of illness and malnutrition and thus compounding drought. Small-scale financial projects, helping women set up little businesses, these sorts of things, they provide a certain continuity and a pathway from recovering from a crisis like a drought towards a more stable future where we will be more resilient when the drought strikes again, because drought certainly will strike again given climate change.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the hard drought across parts of Africa and the Middle East and the famine and disease it is causing. You can join the conversation. Is this what the future holds for the world? More frequent, longer droughts, starvation? Do you believe we can adapt, that these nations can adapt? My guests are the terrific reporting team from the Christian Science Monitor, Ryan Lenora Brown, Scott Peterson, Peter Ford. I want to play some sound here and ask about funding as we move forward here. Back in March, at a White House briefing, director of the White House Office of Management and Budget, Mick Mulvaney, spoke about the president's decision to reduce funding for the UN as part of the administration's America First doctrine.
We're absolutely reducing funding to the UN and to the various foreign aid programs, including those run by the UN and other agencies. That should come as a surprise to no one who watched the campaign. The president said specifically hundreds of times, you covered him, I'm going to spend less money on people overseas and more money on people back home. And that's exactly what we're doing with this budget.
And here was British Prime Minister Theresa May this past March in the House of Commons taking questions from MPs. Stephen Twigg of the Labour Party expressed concern about the Trump administration's plans to cut back on foreign aid.
Will this government take every opportunity to press the Americans to remain fully part of the global humanitarian system?
Prime Minister!
I can assure the Right Honourable Gentleman we recognise the severity and urgency of the crisis that is taking place in East Africa. More than 20 million people face the risk of dying from starvation because of war and drought. And again, it is this country that is leading the way in delivering life-saving support.
Peter Ford, what about funding and cuts, proposed cuts under the Trump administration?
Well, obviously from the point of view of the aid agencies and from the point of view of the people risking death by starvation, they're very, very troubling. I mean, I think one of the most dramatic things that came out of a draft State Department budget, it was an unofficial one, but it was the first look at what might happen, was the complete cancellation of all funding for FUSE. This is a very useful early warning system network that works throughout the Horn of Africa and East Africa. It was created by the United States government in 1985. It's been at the heart of efforts to stave off starvation by predicting drought ever since then. It's still almost completely funded by the United States, and in this budget it gets $0. It must be said, though, that the United States has come through in this particular crisis. Just last month, the government released another $640 million or so after a good deal of pressure from large aid agencies. So the total this year for the four crises, the four famines, is $1.8 billion, which is not to be sneezed at.
Right.
But the problem is, you know, how long will it last and how much pressure do the public agencies and public groups have to keep up on Washington to keep those funds flowing. Mm.
Let's get Elaine in here from Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Elaine, you're on the air.
Hi, I so appreciate your coverage of this issue. As stated, you know, our administration wants to reduce or cut foreign aid, and yet we can spend $1 trillion to update our nuclear arsenal, and that's in addition to the $54 billion that Trump wants to give to the military budget. I also wanted to comment on one of your guests' statement that this is a slow-burning event and it doesn't get news coverage. I belong to an organization called Results. It's a citizens' lobby to help poor countries with health, education, and financial self-reliance. And due to our efforts and the efforts of a lot of other humanitarian organizations, we've reduced the number of children dying every single day from 42,000 to 16,000, which is still a horrible number. But the press never covers that the way they would cover the downing of a plane where 250 Americans die.
Well, good for you, and thanks for your work, Elaine. And by the way, because the aid agencies are having such trouble getting attention to this matter, they've created a coalition campaign. It's called the Global Emergency Response Coalition, and we have a link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. Let's get Vowed in here from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Vowed, you're on the air. Welcome. Jonathan, we'll take you in Patton, Maine. You're on the air. Hi, Jonathan, go ahead.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good, go ahead.
I was calling to ask about the fact that the population of Africa and the Middle East is increasing at a rate faster than it can sustain, both in terms of politically, logistically, climate-wise. And by simply adding on more population by palliatively treating the problem, we're simply encouraging this event to happen again. Mm. Why can't we be proactive like they are in People's Republic of China or India, where they have mass sterilization or birth control programs to prevent such things?
Okay, Jonathan, that's a controversial idea. Scott Peterson, I'll give that to you. What about explosive population growth and how that applies here?
Well, there certainly has been explosive population growth. And looking at Somaliland, for example, since the 1950s, you see that the population has expanded sixfold. The population of livestock has expanded about 4.5-fold, again, since the 50s. And, of course, there aren't, you know, fantastic censuses, you know, too much in between. But we do know that those figures are growing. Now, is that unsustainable? I don't think anyone, certainly in Somalia or Somaliland, will think that there are too many people for the amount of land that's actually there. It's a question of how those resources are managed. And what the foreign minister of Somaliland told me, Saad Ali Shira, was he said, look at, you know, he explained the, you know, how it was going to be necessary. He's literally said, if we still want to raise goats and sheep and camels, we're going to have to do it a different way. We just have to manage differently. He said that what we did 50 years ago in terms of always following the rains and using our nomadic traditions, you know, it worked then. Maybe that was the best way to manage the land. These days, with more demand on resources, we just need to manage them better. No one is suggesting, though, at least in Somaliland, certainly, that there are just too many people, you know, for the place. You know, it's not like Rwanda where you've got every inch spoken for, mm-hmm. You know, or Bangladesh or places where you really have serious population, you know, pressures. It's not quite the same here. So I don't think, you know, anyone's going to be imposing any dramatic programs to ease population growth.
In the couple minutes we have left with you all, I just wanted to get to some of the innovations that are out there or on the horizon to help people in these famine-ravaged areas. I mean, it's as simple as education in some places, Peter Ford. I mean, helping people understand about the things that they can feed their kids, soybeans, for example, not just for animals. You can actually feed them to your children, Peter.
Indeed. And I mean, this is not really rocket science, but there is a tremendous need, certainly in Madagascar, for better education of mothers and young fathers about how children grow and what they need to grow. It's those sorts of things. It's also as simple as putting in a decent water system. Now, I mean, I was in Madagascar. I saw a water system which had developed pipes all the way up a coastline. It had worked for 1 week in the 1960s, and then a piece had broken, and it had never worked since. It's now been rebuilt. So this isn't innovation. But what is innovative, and I do find interesting, is that the money they're handing out in a number of these aid agencies is not... I mean, they're handing out money rather than grain. Grain is difficult to transport, especially when the roads are in lousy state. People with mobile phones can receive cash payments over their phone lines and do something with it and keep themselves alive.
And Ryan Lenora Brown, things like solar dryers that women are learning to use to desiccate fruit and vegetables to store and eat at a later time. These are simple things that are having big impacts.
Yeah, certainly. And, you know, another example in Ethiopia is the government runs a safety net program that provides the 8 million poorest Ethiopians with small cash transfers several months of the year. But what makes it particularly interesting is the cash transfers are then in exchange for public works programs. So these people then are building roads, building schools, building clinics. So, you sort of serve both purposes that way in terms of development and keeping people from experiencing food crises.
Well, I want to thank the three of you for your reporting, your enlightening reporting on this issue, for taking the time to be with us here today. We've learned a lot. Peter Ford, Global Affairs Correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor and cmmonitor.com. Peter, thank you very much.
You're welcome. I was delighted to be on the show.
Thank you. Ryan Lenora Brown, she covers Africa for the Monitor. Ryan, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Jane.
And Scott Peterson, Middle East correspondent for The Monitor. Scott, thanks to you.
Thank you so much for having us, Jane.
Thank you. Well, to the bigger picture now, in a sense of what the future holds, if climate change means droughts like the ones we've been speaking about will become more frequent and how the world might adapt. I'm joined now by Jeffrey DeBalco. He is director of the Environmental Studies Program at Ohio University's School of Leadership and Public Affairs. He was the lead author of the chapter on human security for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's last report in 2014. He joins me via Skype from Copenhagen. Jeffrey DeBalco, really appreciate you being with us. Thank you for being on today.
Hey, my pleasure.
So what do you make of all that you've heard this hour?
Well, the journalists are certainly to be congratulated for telling a complex story that is often cast in exclusively negative terms in ways that highlight the severity of the problem, the life and death problems that are affecting literally millions of people. But they do it in a way that offers avenues forward, talks about things like resilience and in the context of climate change, adapting to climate change, that shows us that it is possible to respond. It has a lot to do with us, as well as some of these factors like droughts and climate change. It has a lot to do with governance and making good decisions and avoiding particularly bad ones. Mm. And so in that sense, I think they've done us a real service in telling these stories.
I heard some optimism in all the terrible news out of that region. I mean, the idea that societies are moving from sort of a pastoral lifestyle to a more agrarian one, learning to thrive in a hotter and hotter world, you know, climate-resistant hybrid crops, that sort of thing. Is there reason to be optimistic here?
Well, if we maybe do it on a spectrum rather than optimistic or pessimistic, I think there are clearly ways that people on the ground and with assistance from outside aid agencies and even their governments are finding ways to change. Change to, as you might say, better adapt their ways of making a living to these stresses. That said, there are going to be a lot of casualties. It's very difficult, and there's not a kind of nirvana end state necessarily that we can see. Mm-hmm. But we have to maintain that degree of optimism to go forward. And I think some of the innovations highlighted give us hope. I think we need to do it, however, with our eyes open. And so in some ways, it's easy, whether it's in the laboratory or in an aid agency headquarters or even in the capital of some of these countries, to say, well, all we need to do is switch from this crop to that crop and things will be better. Mm-hmm. Or get in the case of soybeans, well, we just convince them to eat it or convince them to do their livestock differently. And we have to remember that it's more than just a kind of detached, rational decision where they're optimizing outcomes and calories or income, and understand that in many cases, these are identity questions, cultural questions, passed down knowledge that takes time to change that may be painful to change. Mm.
Certainly, there are political and military factors associated with these famines, as we heard from our reporters. Certainly, climate change is part of the equation, as they reported. You've said that the least responsible for climate change will be the most vulnerable. You've also said we need to get out of the climate response box. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that, like, naturally, a lot of issues, we identify them, we draw lines around them, and we see an appropriate set of responses for climate change. And there are people who work on climate change. And instead, we need to understand this set of challenges around climate as something that affects us all. And so that's affects us all, rich and poor, in different ways. Although in this case, those least responsible, i.e. have produced the fewest greenhouse gases, are going to be highly vulnerable because of their poverty, because of where they live and such. But at the same time, we need to think creatively. And some of this came out in the coverage from the Christian Science Monitor, in areas that aren't necessarily what we first think of with climate change. So the question of remittances and getting money from abroad and the expat community from these areas and making that easier. And some of that's technology. Some of it's about labor mobility and labor laws, you know, not typically what we think of with a climate change. And we need to understand that we all will be impacted. We all have responsibility, and we can't just say, well, the folks who do climate.
Jeffrey, are you there? Well, it has been an interesting hour. We have been speaking with Jeffrey DeBelko, director of the Environmental Studies Program at Ohio University's School of Leadership and Public Affairs. He was, of course, the lead author of the chapter on human security in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's last report in 2014. Listeners, a lot to think about this hour. You will find links to aid agencies who are raising funds to take on this food crisis we've been talking about. You can continue this conversation, get the On Point podcast, all of our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about pot. It is legal now in 29 states, but not at the federal level, and Attorney General Jeff Sessions wants to declare war on that. Tom Ashbrook is back for that. Until then, I'm Jane Clayson. Thanks for being with us. This is On Point.